The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
This idea of black manhood in the face of racism and white supremacy, how does this person end up a Donald Trump voter? So that was step one. And then the second part of it was one of the things that I'm obsessed with, and then I'll flip this to Barbara. One of the things I'm obsessed with is the question of masculinity. You know, there was a meeting earlier today called Capitalism and the Gender Binary, and one of the things that was said in the wrap-up by a comrade named Leachy is she said, you know, the one thing we didn't talk about today is we talked about what it means to be trans, what it means to be a woman, but we didn't talk about what it means to grow up a boy in this society and how stultifying that journey can be from boy to man, and how much that can limit your options and your view when everything is about be a man, be a man, be a man. And I'm of the belief that Jim Brown laid down the template through his play in the NFL of a lot of these ideas that we have in our head about what it means to quote unquote be a man. And looking at where he devoted his life, and this is like every chapter in the book is devoted to one of these things, it's like Jim Brown in football, proud of the fact that he missed zero games. No matter how much he got hurt, he never missed a game. Jim Brown, part of the Black Power movement, but the very conservative edge of the Black Power movement, a part of the Black Power movement we don't normally talk about, which we will talk about. Jim Brown, part of blaxploitation cinema in the 1970s, which had its own construction of what black masculinity looked like. Jim Brown doing very admirable work with gangs in South Central Los Angeles and beyond, but also Jim Brown, decades of allegations of violence against women. And that led me to this other question, which is about black masculinity as a tool to fight racism. And it made me think a lot about the famous sign at the 1968 Memphis sanitation strike that said, "I am a man." You know, and how moving that is. Or when Malcolm X was assassinated and Ossie Davis in his eulogy said, "Malcolm was our manhood." But is there another side of that as well that leads to the marginalizing of black women when we use masculinity as a tool against racism? Does it also have this underside to it that serves to marginalize black women and women of color? And I wanted to ask Barbara about that, about experiences in your time as an activist, particularly throughout the 1970s.
Yes,
about marginalization.
That was going on. I do want to say something, though, about why I thought it'd be great for us to have this conversation here at the conference. This is my second year attending the Socialism Conference. Really happy that that's true. We'll see if we make it the third. But I met Dave at the conference briefly last year, and I know who Dave is, although I could hardly be described as a sports fan, because I'm not sure if you count the Winter Olympics, skating and what have you, not sure. Anyway, that's about as far as I go with all of that. But when Dave asked me last fall if I would do a blurb for the book, I was kind of like, why? You know, I didn't say that to him, but I did. The thing I did say to him immediately was, "Oh, that's so nice that you would ask me." Sorry, excuse me. Are you going to be writing about Jim Brown's long history of violence against women? And Dave, of course, gave me the right answer, which was, "Oh, I have a chapter on it." So I said, "Oh, well, in that case, I could probably read the book and have something to say about the book," because he was letting me know that he was interrogating that history. So after reading the book, I found out some really interesting things about Jim Brown's politics that, well, in more detail than I would have known had I not, particularly about his conservatism, but also around his activism. He was the founder of this organization, the Black Economic Union, and they were in different places. And it was really, I think, about economic development, kind of in a mainstream way. It wasn't about smashing capitalism. Mm-hmm. It was about how do we get some economic opportunity in our poor economically challenged black community. So, as I said, I didn't really know about that. And of course, I did know about his work with gangs. But I just thought it'd be interesting for us to have the experience of dialoguing about this book about someone who was, in many ways, is a why black, in many ways, is the reason, the kind of person he is the reason that black feminism had to come into existence.
And that's I'd start with there, because in case there are folks who are new to these kinds of conversations, how do you define black feminism?
One of the things I say about black feminism is when people say that whatever they say about the term, I always explain that black feminism is a noun. It's not about a feminist who is black, it's about a politic.
Right.
And Kianga's book right here, about the Combahee River Collective and the Combahee River Collective statement, really kind of embodies and illustrates what I mean by a politic. Because some people think when one says that one is a black feminist, you're saying, oh yeah, you're just describing your heritage in relationship to being a feminist. No, we're talking about a particular set of political principles. They're laid out very well in the Combahee River Collective statement, which is included in the book, and it's widely available elsewhere, I'm sure, including online. One of the hallmarks of black feminism is that we look at all oppressions. We address all oppressions. Now, the Combahee River Collectives, and I have to stop myself, this is the first public presentation I've done since I found out the accurate pronunciation of Combahee. It is not Combahee, it's Cumbee.
Wow.
Yeah, C-U-M-B-E-E. I don't know if anybody's from South Carolina or Georgia or whatever, but I heard a podcast, a wonderful podcast, that was done around the some anniversary, like probably 150-something anniversary of Harriet Tubman's raid on the Combahee River that freed over 750 enslaved people. Now that's why we named ourselves that. But they went down to South Carolina and interviewed people who lived out there, and they consistently called it the Combahee River. I said, oh my goodness, 40 plus years. But to get back to the politics of the Combahee or Combahee Heat River Collective. We saw the systems of oppression as interlocking. We also were a group that either by happenstance or by destiny were a part of the left. And that's one of the things that characterizes and that distinguishes the Combahee River Collective, because we were not liberal feminists or bourgeois feminists. We did not think that just addressing sexism in the black community or in the society at large was going to solve our realities and our issues and address all of the issues that we faced. We knew that we had to deal with class oppression as well as racism and white supremacy, and also, of course, then with sexism. And with in those days, back in the mid late 70s, there was not even any words to describe the oppression that people who were not heterosexual and gender conforming faced. So we actually talked about in the statement, we say heterosexual oppression, because we didn't have heterosexism and we didn't have transphobia and we didn't have homophobia. But anyway, we say in the first paragraph or so of the statement that the systems of oppression are interlocking, and that in order for us to work on liberation and to get to liberation, we have to work on all of these interlocking oppressions. And I think that is what most characterizes black feminism, that we, out of our own identities, we also include and coined the phrase identity politics. That's where it first appears. And of course, we know what has happened with identity politics. It has been beaten to death and, you know, misrepresented, and there are attacks on it both from the left and the right, which is really interesting. But what we meant is that because we had this particular standpoint, and that's a term from another black woman scholar, because we had a particular standpoint as people who were simultaneously experiencing these oppressions, that we had a particular politic to bring. We also were motivated to define black feminism and more importantly to practice black feminism, because we were not assumed to have any political agency of our own as black women and as women of color. So we wanted to assert and did assert that we could build a politic that addressed the issues that we face, and that that was legitimate. One other characteristic of the collective was that we were internationalists and saw our link, ourselves being linked to struggles for liberation around the globe.
You see, that's why I wanted you to blurb the book, and that's also why I was overjoyed when you asked about us doing this event together here at the conference, because reading this book was transformative for me. There are probably several rooms where people would look at me side-eye if I introduced myself and said, "How do you do? I'm a black feminist." And I understand that. But what I did want was to apply the principles of black feminism to speaking about Jim Brown. And those principles to me, like the starting point, and by the way, not to shock anybody, but doing a book about Jim Brown, where you're saying, "Hello, I'm applying the principles of the Cumbie River Collective," isn't exactly the sort of thing that makes publishers say, "Wow, now that sounds like
that's
a winner."
Great.
That's a winner. And but yeah, really didn't care, and did a lot of stuff to get this through the publisher. You know, I tell this story in the book about Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. Are people familiar with that movie? It was like foundational film, very political, and the lead character in many respects was based on this idealized version of Jim Brown, played by Melvin Van Peebles. And I'm sorry to go off on this digression, but Melvin Van Peebles couldn't get money to make a movie where you had this revenge spree against the cops and against racism that was inspired by French New Wave cinema. Shockingly, he couldn't get funding for that. So one of the things about the, it's a critique of how white people view black male sexuality is a huge part of the film. And so the lead character has this job where he has sex and wealthy people watch him from windows. And so what Melvin Van Peebles did was he sent footage of just the sex scenes and said, "Well, I'm making a pornographic film." And people sent him funding so he could do that. And on the down low, he used funding to make the film. At one point, he contracted venereal disease and then sued his while doing these very realistic sexually simulated scenes. And then he sued his producer for workers' comp because of his venereal disease. And that's how he got the money to make the film. And similarly, I was sending pages to my to my editor. I'm not comparing myself to Melvin Van Peebles here. There's nothing that crazy. But no, but I'm sending pages that was just like the football stuff. And I'll be like, "Here, talk about a game right here. Here, talk about this run right here. Isn't this great?" And they'd be like, great. Here's a little money for you. Keep going." And well, meanwhile, I'm reading this book. I'm reading Kianga's other book, From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation, and really thinking through to myself, like, how can I be true to these politics? And one of the ways in terms of writing this book is that the starting point is that Jim Brown is not in any way, shape, or form the villain of this book. The villain of this book is the fact that this is a racist society and this is a misogynistic society, and people grow up trying to manage their lives, particularly a young black kid, Jim Brown, who's growing up on St. Simon's Island, and his mother left to work as a domestic in Long Island, and he's being raised by his great-grandmother and his grandmother, and from the time he's born, they nickname him Man. So he's the man of the house from age zero. And he's Man from ages 0 to 8, and then his mother sends for him, and he refuses to call, he never calls her Mama for the rest of his life. Because he's like, "No, you left me, I'm at a remove from you. And I'm going to be this man who," and part of how manhood then gets defined in his own mind from early on is the way I think manhood is taught to generations of young people, which is this idea of you don't show emotion, you don't show psychological pain, and you don't, and it's fiercely heterosexual, like you define yourself by on the basis of sexual conquest. And part of that is also if women attempt to assert their voice, part of being a man is to silence that voice. And that's what I wanted to ask you about with regards to the Black freedom struggle, because as Jim Brown comes up, he's got this unassailable manhood, and it sounds very radical, because, you know, we live in a society, they call Black men boys, they tear apart Black families, and here he is saying, no, I'm a man, and I will not be treated as anything less than a man. And when he says that to people in power, like the owner of the Cleveland Browns, it sounds really intensely revolutionary. But then when he's saying it to his wife, or when he's saying it to women in the movement, like, you were actually hurting the black family by daring to argue mm-hmm. with me, then it comes out as something very different. Mm-hmm. And that has to do with sexism in the movement, sexism in struggle, mm-hmm. and I wanted to ask you right. about dealing with that.
So that was the question that we began with, which was, what was it like in the 1970s to be politically conscious mm-hmm. As a Black woman? And to be involved in struggle, but so sorry to be hoarse, it's usually in the morning, I'm not sure what's happening. But anyway, just let me continue to hack. But anyway, as I said, it was just really challenging to figure out a political path at that time. I was involved in the civil rights movement in the early 1960s as a teenager, growing up in Cleveland, Ohio. And then I went to college in the mid-60s and was involved in the movement to end the war in Vietnam. Quite involved. In fact, this is the 50th anniversary year of my being on the streets of Chicago and in Grant Park. Thank you. At the Chicago Convention demonstrations, and I thought, wow, it's really something to be coming back 50 years later to Chicago when I was here 50 years ago out there trying to help end this war.
What was that like?
We don't want to digress.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, we can digress about that later. I want to try to answer your first question.
Sorry.
It's okay. Because I love to digress, but I'm going to try not to an extreme degree. So anyway, as I said, then, you know, like the 60s, you know, I'm just really happy. I think I'm one of the most blessed people on earth to have come of age politically in the 1960s and to have been a part of that age group, the baby boom generation that really transformed the nation. As far as what we thought rights were, what we thought was important, values, everything happened during that era. The Black struggle, the movement to end the war in Vietnam, the student movement and free speech, the women's movement, 69, next year is the 50th anniversary of Stonewall, all of those things happened. In a 10-year period, and depending on your politics, you either think it was one of the best years or the best decades of the 20th century, or you think it was the worst. And you can tell where people are coming from depending on what they mm-hmm. think about, particularly 68. Because we have programs and presentations about 68 here at the conference because it was such a pivotal year. When I, by the time I graduated from college and then went to grad school, I actually thought I would never be politically active again because of the shift from civil rights politics, which were fading even by the mid-60s, but because of the shift to a Black nationalist, Black power, Black liberation kind of mode, which was so male-dominated. It was incredibly male-dominated. And here I was, like a bright, shiny new bachelor's degree, you know? And that's not to say anything except that my family cared about my sister and me and helped us to get there, because we didn't do it ourselves, you know, it was because of them. But they did want us to have a better life. And so I'm all ready to utilize the skills that I was fortunate to obtain, and I'm being told that the best thing I could do is to walk either 3 or 7 steps behind and have babies for the nation. And don't think that I'm exaggerating. That was what good black women were being told that we needed to do. And we negotiated that in various and different ways. Women in SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, did indeed write a paper, and a paper that was circulated amongst SNCC members about women in the movement. There were women speaking out, black women and other women were speaking out about the kind of strange mix of revolutionary, radical and revolutionary politics, and like just dead up sexism. It was happening in Students for a Democratic Society and SDS. It wasn't just, you know, in a black context that all of this was happening. So I honestly thought I would never be politically active again, because I just didn't see any way for that to be the case. And then black feminism. And I found out about the first national conference, or Eastern Regional Conference, of the National Black Feminist Organization, which was in New York in 1973. As many of you know, I'm a twin, and I found out about it from my twin sister, who was working at Ms. Magazine, of all places, during that time. And there was a wonderful black feminist there named Margaret Sloan, who was one of the founders of the organization. And that was like, that changed my life, you know. That was just, you know, before and after. I was already teaching black women's literature, however, during that time period. But as I said, it was just really hard to negotiate. Now, I came out in the mid-70s, and as I was saying to Dave before we started, that in some ways, because I was a feminist and also a lesbian, that I, in some ways, buffered my personal life from some of those kinds of challenging contradictions. But I was still living in a society that was sexist, misogynist, homophobic, and transphobic, so I could only buffer so far. I mean, we're all affected by these isms. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to build something, and we wanted to build something that was inclusive. I think that's one of the big mistakes that people make about feminism of women of color, in particular, particularly when it is left and socialist feminists of color who are doing the defining of the politics, because we have an understanding of global capitalism and of the systems that are keeping everybody down. So it's not about, you know, fix my problems and the rest of you can go hang. No, that's not what it was at all. And we were also black, and we had grown up during Jim Crow. So we really had a firm grasp on reality and a firm grasp on how this people-hating, people-exploiting system worked. So, you know, we built. And it was really hard to read this book for me, because I knew I was reading a book page after page, as good as a book is. I was reading a book about someone, Jim Brown namely, who, if we encountered each other, would indeed look down on me. And not only look down on me, when he found out what I was about, you know, I would be one of those race traitors, you know? So.
Yeah, that's one of the things that, first of all, made it very hard to write about. But one of the things that I was confronting in writing it is that people, you have to understand Jim Brown as a football player. Because the person on the field, he was described by Michael Eric Dyson, who I interviewed for the book, described him as a Greek god in African skin. And it was like something that, and someone that hadn't been seen before. In the think about the context, he's playing in the 1950s and early 1960s. And there are still teams in the National Football League that won't even sign black players. And here's Jim Brown, who can't be stopped. Here's Jim Brown running over white tacklers. Here's Jim Brown, whose manhood is unassailable in the ultimate male game, that is football. And because of that, he becomes, and I interviewed so many people who this was the case, like they, he becomes this idol in a way that's detached from the actual politics in his head. And so people just think that he's, it's not just like young people who are looking up to him on the football field. Huey Newton was really enamored with Jim Brown and would go to his house and speak to him for hours and hours and hours. Jim Brown even spoke at Huey Newton's funeral. And it raises the question of, well, what did they talk about? and that's something that I asked Jim Brown, and he was just like, oh man, we just talked. Because I got to speak to Jim Brown a little bit for the book. Most of my questions, he said, I'm not answering that. But on this particular one, he said, we just talked about life, and then he sort of looked out, you know, into the distance. But I think the root of it is that people just looked up to him. I mean, Kevin Blackstone, who's a sports writer, I mean, people gotta understand, he called Jim Brown the emperor of black masculinity. I mean, people just, like, their views of him were so hyperbolic because of his ability to run through white tacklers, basically, and not miss a single game during a time of protracted and intense white supremacy. And even his name, you know, Jim Brown. I mean, it makes you think of John Brown. It makes you think of John Henry. It makes you think of this person who cannot be stopped. And one of the things that I found so interesting, like, and you got, there's sports writers, like left-wing sports writers, writing in like the Washington Post, when Jim Brown would play against teams that were all white, they would write things like, Jim Brown practiced his own form of integration by integrating the faces of the tacklers trying to keep him out of the goal line. They got integrated the Jim Brown way, you know? And so it's this way of talking about it. And one of the things that it did is it created a person whose image was actually separate from the conservatism of his politics. And that's why, one reason why I called the book Last Man Standing is that he represents this mode of masculinity that, hopefully, Donald Trump aside, is going by the wayside, that very toxic form of masculinity. But just a quick story that I found so interesting is, in 1968, Jim Brown endorses Richard Nixon. And this is even while he's hanging out with Huey Newton. He endorses Richard. Why does he endorse Richard Nixon? Well, one of the reasons is that actually wasn't that uncommon among a sector of black America at that time. And Richard Nixon actually did speeches where he called for black power. And it was this idea of co-opting the phrase of black power and using it to mean black capitalism, using it to mean Booker T. Washington style, you know, don't make political demands anymore, just drop those buckets and get to work. And Richard Nixon, and that's very in line with Jim Brown's politics. So he endorses Richard Nixon. And other people who endorse Richard Nixon include the singer James Brown and Sammy Davis Jr. When I went back and I looked at a lot of the black press from 68, I found numerous columns excoriating James Brown for endorsing Nixon, excoriating Sammy Davis Jr. for endorsing. I could not find one word of criticism against Jim Brown. It's almost like he was above political criticism because of the representation that sports provided for him. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just wanted to say something about this idea of being a credit to the race, because that's what you're really talking about. And having grown up in that era that you're talking about, and I remember that Sammy Davis Jr. indeed did endorse Nixon, didn't remember that James Brown had. But the thing is that if you're a credit to the race, you can have a lot of like chinks your armor or whatever, because you're doing something that helps to move the race along. And this is in the context of Jim Crow and segregation. Mm-hmm. Today, you know, like, having lived as long as I have and seen the different evolutions of what it means to be a black person in the United States, my mind is really, it's hard for me to understand that Beyonce is a queen of the world. It's really hard for me to grasp that. I mean, I know it's true, and I see the evidence. You know, it's not that I don't, you know, I disbelieve what my eyes are telling me and what I'm seeing. It's because I come from an era where there were no black people on television. Do you see what I'm saying? To go from the beginning of my life when there were no black people on TV, except for on Ed Sullivan's show, Tap Dancing, and Beulah, the show about being a domestic worker for a white family. Those are the two shows that were on. Oh, let me not forget Amos and Andy. Yeah, so that was, and now a black woman is queen of the world, and people really revere her and treat her that way. I mean, she's really in some ways above the Queen of England and, you know, other people who are, you know, actually titled royalty because of her impact and because of her talent. So it's different. It's a different era. So if somebody's a credit to the race, then they get to as I said, have these contradictions, and there were many, many contradictions at that time.
Yeah, you mentioned the different era, and I got it. I worked on two books simultaneously. One was the Jim Brown book, and the other is this book up here by Michael Bennett that says Things That Make White People Uncomfortable. And you read the book by Michael Bennett, and what he talks about is intersectionality. Mm-hmm. He talks about feminism. He talks about the kind of world he wants his daughters to grow up in. And as Jesse can tell you, when we were interviewing Michael Bennett for the book, he would think nothing about just break down crying and just cry and be vulnerable and speak about his family. And it's like, that to me is the future in so many respects. Like this idea of actually being in touch with who you are as an individual. And while with Jim Brown, I'll never forget, I traveled across the country to talk to him and ended up living underneath his pool for 4 days. This is true. And it's very nice. He said, you can help yourself to anything in the fridge, but all I brought was like big bottles of water and some Clif Bars. And I just like, because I was scared to eat out of his fridge. I just was like, he was 78 at the time. He's an extremely intimidating individual. In every respect, like his idea of a smile is sort of like this, and you don't want to see the frown. And but I asked him. I said, "What makes a man, in your mind? What makes a man?" Let me hear it from you, because his whole life, I'm talking from the 1950s on. He says, like, no one's gonna make me feel like anything less than a man. I mean, he used the manhood trope to say why he didn't support Dr. King, and said, he said, if I ever have to march, I'll march alone. I'm a man. I don't believe in marching with other people. And it's like, and we could talk about that. And he's been consistent with that through 60 years, before and after the assassination of Dr. King. I mean, I'll tell you in a second what he said when I asked him about being a man, but even like this past year, he went on CNN to blast John Lewis. Absolutely blast John Lewis, because John Lewis said that he thought Donald Trump was an illegitimate president. And Jim Brown gets up there and he says, John Lewis has offended me. He doesn't know what he's talking about. I mean, I guess I give John Lewis credit for marching in all those parades all those years ago.
Where he almost died.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And those parades. So, but when he said that, people were like shocked and appalled, and how could Jim Brown say this? And I'm like, parades, that's what he called them in the early 60s too. Like, he has not changed. He's like, these aren't marches, these aren't confrontations with police, these aren't things where you risk your life and get your head split open. I mean, Edmund Pettus Bridge and all the rest of it. These are parades. And he has not shifted from that. Mm-hmm. And so I say to him, like, so what is a manhood? What is manhood? What makes a man? And he said some things about familial responsibility and heading up a household. And then he said, and you never dance. And when he said that, it's like my head split in two different directions. Because one of those things, you never dance, the first thing I thought about was, you know, okay, he's saying, like, you never tap dance, you never dance for the man, you never, you know, pretend that, like you can, like that you're there to be some sort of entertainer, you need to treat me like a man, you never dance. But there's this other side to it too, like that whole, like there's a whole book by Norman Mailer called Tough Guys Don't Dance. And this idea that you never dance, because to dance is to be vulnerable, like to dance is to outwardly show pleasure, to dance is to laugh, and to do any of these things leaves you vulnerable somehow. And that's, I really do see that less as an indictment of Jim Brown and more of an indictment of a society that we live in that raises people to say, you never dance, because to do so would leave you in some way, shape, or form vulnerable to the slings and arrows of this society.
I'm looking at my notes, and there are a couple of things I want to make sure that we get in, because I think our time is coming to a close. And one is to kind of connect Jim Brown's continuing impact, not to say just his legacy, to the moment that we're in now, with athletes speaking out about oppression and doing, you know, really flying in the face of sports establishments and social societal establishments. And I want to make sure we had talked, when we talked to prepare for this, I had talked about violence against women mm-hmm. in the context of the release of the film, The Color Purple.
Yes.
And I want to kind of get that one in. And then there's a third thing I want to get in, which is that I grew up in the neighborhood where Jim Brown lived. So I told Dave that when we first started being in contact about this book. And that, and I, then I always, when I tell people that, I said, and I want you to understand, we're not talking about a Beverly Hills type neighborhood.
Right.
We're talking about a regular black neighborhood where a number of people own their homes, but it would be described, I think, accurately as a lower middle class, our middle class neighborhood, that is black middle class neighborhood. Mm-hmm. But we're talking about people, one of our neighbors down the street was a Pullman porter, and he was highly respected because that was one of the best jobs that a black man could have at that time. My mother, who was a college graduate, she worked as a nurse's aide and as a supermarket cashier. So she had a degree. But that's the kind of job, you know, that she had. But as I said, Jim Brown lived not far from us because of racism in home, you know, buying and home loans, redlining, etc. You could only buy houses in a few neighborhoods in Cleveland at the time I was growing up, which was simultaneous with the time that he was playing for the Browns. So that's why he lived in our neighborhood. Mm. Not because it was like a fancy, like right. where you went to visit, that's a whole different matter.
Right.
But the thing
right.
is that we lived in the same neighborhood because of segregation and racism. But we were very excited about the fact that he did live in the neighborhood, particularly because we had friends who lived on the same street that he did. As I said, not far away from where we lived, but we weren't putting it together like that. We just thought, well, yeah, he lives in our neighborhood. We didn't have an analysis.
And I want to ask you about The Color Purple. And
okay.
First of all, show of hands of people who have seen The Color Purple or read The Color Purple.
Movie, though. We're talking about movie.
We are talking
yeah,
about
not,
the movie.
Not musical or anything else.
Well,
yeah.
First, where this connects with Jim Brown, this is in the book, is that Jim Brown attempted something very radical with Richard Pryor and to start their own film company in Hollywood. I mean, Jim Brown, frustrated by just getting the blaxploitation film roles, goes to Richard and says, let's make our own films. And this is what they were talking about in the late 70s and early 80s. They talked about, we need to make black films, and we need to have not just black films in front of the camera, but behind the camera. They were talking about black directors, black producers, scene designers. And the whole thing imploded, as we talk about in the book, if people want to read about him and Richard Pryor, just had a falling out for the ages. But two of the early projects that they passed on that was just right there on their desk saying, we want you, Indigo Pictures, to make this. One was The Color Purple. And the second was a little film called Purple Rain. And, which is its own story. But but it's interesting that they passed on The Color Purple.
It is.
And it is with that I passed it.
Right. This is not directly connected to Jim Brown's life. But what I was saying today when we were talking about the issue of violence against women in the black community, when the film came out, which was what, probably
85?
Yeah, mid-80s,
yeah.
I was at an academic association conference, the Association for the Study of Afro-American Life and History. People know that, that organization because it still exists. And the Color Purple film, probably the book too, but even more so the film because more people saw it, caused a furor in the black community. People were very divided about whether the book ever should have been written, the film, because of the fact that it was an accurate depiction of violence against women. So we were in a workshop, our session, talking about The Color Purple, and the battle was going on, you know, and the session. And there's a middle-aged man who stood up and he said, and he was black, he said, most of the people who go to that, or did, at least at that time, were black, to that conference. And he said, my wife is an emergency room nurse. And if you think that anything in The Color Purple is exaggerated or untrue, you need to do a shift with her. in the emergency room because of what she has told me about what she's experienced. I never forgot it because it was such a convincing. I mean, this is a real black person talking about his actual black life, who works in an emergency room. It's real. I don't think it necessarily changed people's minds, but it was a profound moment to say, this is happening. This is real. Mm.
And we're just about out of time. Ready for any questions, but I wanted to say one thing before we stop. I just wanted to thank you, Barbara Smith, so much, because I've been going around doing talks about this book, and just the same way you heard Barbara Smith say that the book was difficult to read, it was difficult to write, and it's also been very difficult to talk about, because these aren't necessarily fun stories, you know, and these aren't stories that I got into this world to communicate, but they're still important stories because it speaks to a history that we need to know and reckon with, especially when you have all sorts of very good people in the sports world, like Colin Kaepernick, who have been absolutely shocked that Jim Brown hasn't had their back. Mm. And so it's like, okay, we need to be able to explain this, which is why I wrote the book, but it was really difficult. And this is the first time I've ever spoken about the book that I actually felt good about myself afterwards, and not that I needed to shower with steel wool to get the scent off. I actually feel really good. I might not shower for days. No, I'm just, but.
You're so crazy.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I knew that about you.
Yeah, but it's because of you and the perspective and that you bring to this. So I wanted to say thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for the opportunity.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.